The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. A declassified memo sheds light on President Obama's last days in office.
This was an effort by an outgoing administration to undermine and to destroy an incoming administration.
But the media are disinterested in the melee.
But it does look increasingly as if we have become a land of no consequences since Barack Obama left the White House.
Meanwhile, hatred of President Trump escalates, if that's possible.
All sorts of standards have gone out the window in this time.
And China faces a world hesitant to do business with it.
Don't expect them to go quietly in the night. They're going to fight this tooth and nail.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at hughhewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. Throughout the past 70 plus years, as communist regimes proliferated in parts of the world, people escaped horrible conditions and entered the free world with incredible stories. Salem host Sebastian Gorka's parents escaped communist Hungary in 1956. Decades later, Hungary was free, and the Gorkas moved back. What a young Gorka experienced there made him who he is today, and it explains why he so loves the freedom of America and is deeply troubled by what he sees threatening it today. This week, Sebastian Gorka discussed those early years.
After the fall of communism, I went to live in the land of my parents' birth. My father and my mother escaped communist Hungary during the revolution, the glorious revolution of 1956. 37 years after their escape across a minefield to freedom, to the West, I went to live and work in Hungary. The wall had fallen. The Hungarian people had, for the first time since 1948, freely chosen their own government. And they elected conservatives. The first freely elected post-communist government was made out of conservatives. And I was offered a job in the defense ministry of a newly free Hungary. I lived there for 15 years. I was married there, had two children grow up. But I learnt what two generations of communist dictatorship does to the soul of a people. More than once, the people of that great nation of Hungary re-elected the former communists. Yes, when given a free choice, they actually elected former communists into government. Now, they had relabeled themselves as socialists, but these were the people who were members of the last regime, members of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, members of the Politburo. After the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was no Nuremberg trial equivalent for the Eastern Bloc. In Hungary, none of the people who were responsible for the murders of the past regime, for the crushing of the 1956 revolution, none of the secret police who had tortured free men and women, like my father, were ever convicted. This had a price. Why? Because it led to what someone, a Hungarian writer, termed Hungary becoming the land of no consequences. My question to you, my friends, is, has America become a land of no consequences? I know we've never been a fascist or communist dictatorship. We don't have political prisons. We don't have the death penalty for ideological dissension. But it does look increasingly as if we have become a land of no consequences since Barack Obama left the White House. I'm looking at the screen. We have the news, and I see a Chyron. I see A.G. Barr states, the Attorney General, don't expect criminal investigations of Barack Obama or Vice President Biden as a result of our investigations of the Russian collusion hoax. I didn't know that was going to happen as I prepared for the show, but now, more than ever, I will ask the question, where are the consequences? Where are the consequences for Barack Obama's political appointee, Lois Lerner, using the IRS, the Inland Revenue Service, to target conservatives? Where are the consequences of his attorney general, Eric Holder, who proudly said, I'm the president's wingman? Where are the consequences for Eric Holder deciding to provide weapons to Mexican drug cartels in Operation Fast and Furious, in some asinine attempt to locate the way they get them by giving them weapons. Weapons that on at least one occasion would be used to kill an American federal agent.
The mysterious memo Susan Rice allegedly sent to herself has finally been declassified. In it, we discover President Obama, Vice President Biden, and others in the White House meeting on January 5, 2017, discussed withholding information from the incoming administration because of alleged security concerns. Fred Fleitz is a former CIA analyst. He also worked as chief of staff and executive secretary of the National Security Council under President Trump. He discussed the Rice memo while on Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Prof and Amy Jacobson.
How about what Susan Rice said in 2017 versus what Susan Rice memorialized about this January 5th, 2017 meeting?
Well, I mean, she's lying. Clearly, she knew that there was electronic surveillance of General Flynn. And what this comes down to was the intention of the Obama administration from the top, from President Obama, not to honor a very important principle of our democracy, and that's called the peaceful transfer of power. And under that principle, the outgoing administration cooperates fully with the incoming one. It honors the will of the people, turns over the keys to the offices, tells them about foreign policy initiatives underway, gives them all the intelligence operations and intelligence that they've collected. They don't withhold information from the incoming president and tell career officers to use this information to investigate the Mexican administration, to undermine it. It's really a very serious violation of our whole system of government. If they had concerns about General Flynn, they had to tell the next administration about it. Maybe they could have told President Trump or Vice President Pence. But and Comey admitted later, he admitted that he withheld information from Attorney General Sessions about Russia also. I mean, this was an effort by an outgoing administration to undermine and to destroy an incoming administration.
Well, has this ever happened in our nation's history before where you do have that outgoing president spying on the incoming president?
I think it's unprecedented. And it's interesting that when a peacetime intelligence service was set up after World War II, there were real concerns. It could be used to spy on the American people. And in 1978, when the FISA Act was implemented, protections were put in place to make it harder for NSA to spy on the American people. I mean, there were strong limits. But nobody conceived of an incumbent administration spying on a presidential campaign, never mind after that candidate wins the election, to continue to do so during the transition to undermine that president once he's in office.
Talk to us as a former CIA analyst. Talk to us. Give us a little bit more color on unmasking and the number of requests made and this seeming cover story that Comey had as memorialized in the memo and that Brennan had on the cable TV news shows, basically saying, well, that's a lot of communication that Flynn is having with the Russian ambassador. So since that's unusual, that gives us the predicate for doing some unusual things in reaction.
First of all, it's not unusual for an incoming national security advisor to speak to foreign officials so he can hit the ground running when he comes in. Because our foreign intelligence agencies are not supposed to spy on Americans, if an American name is captured accidentally in the collection, it's redacted or masked. Now, if you're a senior official, you can get that name, but you have to have a good reason, and it's only provided to that person. Now, I know there's a lot of experts running around saying that unmasking is very common. Even some Republicans are saying that. I was in the CIA 19 years. I didn't know how to make an unmasking request for the first 13. I'd never heard of one. It's very uncommon. It's true there's 8,000 to 9,000 a year, but we have about 2 million people with top secret clearances. They read millions and millions of pieces of intelligence a year. It's actually not that common, and it's very sensitive. And the fact that there were 53 requests by 39 individuals between Election Day and January 12th for General Flynn's name is unbelievable that so many officials needed to know this. And I don't understand how NSA personnel could cooperate with requests for members of the Trump campaign in transition. Were there no whistleblowers? Were there no complaints to inspector generals?
Well, here's the other thing, too, about Flynn. It's not like he was some sort of rogue out of left field. I mean, he was the defense intelligence head during the Obama administration for a brief stint until he fell out of favor because Obama fell out of favor with him. And so I wonder if there was something personal there in addition to, obviously, the very personal feelings about Trump's victory.
Well, they did see him as a rogue. He didn't fit the mold. He pursued analysis that the Obama administration didn't want to see. He strongly opposed the Obama administration on the Iran nuclear deal. He wanted to significantly reorganize the U.S. intelligence community, which I might add seems to be starting now. But this started with General Flynn. I think the intelligence community was determined that he not head the National Security Council. And another thing, he was an experienced Trump guy coming into the government. Trump and his close advisors did not have a lot of national security experience. Flynn did. He's a general. He headed the Defense Intelligence Agency, and removing him and he was hostile to the Obama administration's agenda. Removing him was a high priority, I think, for government careerists.
And how common or uncommon is the manipulation of the media to the ends of intel or law enforcement?
It's too common, and it reminds me of CIA Director Goss, who tried to reform the CIA for George W. Bush, and CIA careerists heavily leaked to the news media to undermine him. Unfortunately, it drove Goss out as CIA director. Career officers know how to do this in the government. And what's different about President Trump is that he fights back, and his staff fights back, and they know how to work the media.
Coming up, the stifling hatred of Donald Trump.
All sorts of standards have gone out the window in this time.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. General Michael Flynn's reputation has been dragged through the mud for years. And it's particularly disturbing that without Acting Director of National Intelligence Richard Grenell's decision to declassify key documents, the general's reputation would remain tarnished. How is it possible that so many Democrats kept this so well hidden? Where were the whistleblowers? Where was the media? And now we have Federal District Judge Emmett Sullivan delaying what should be an easy decision to dismiss the case against General Flynn. That injustice continued. Washington Examiner Chief Political Correspondent Byron York joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Do you think Judge Sullivan is going to stare down law, precedent, judgment just to satisfy the blue bubble and keep Flynn dangling?
I'm not the lawyer here, so I can't predict on that basis. I have been kind of stunned by this. I mean, remember, Judge Sullivan is the one who, in open court, suggested that Michael Flynn had betrayed his country, and after the lunch break had to kind of come back and walk that
back a little bit, but it was still really quite astonishing. And Judge Sullivan is the one who, when the government says, oh, you know that 302, that original 302, which is the write-up of the interview that FBI agents did with Michael Flynn January 24, 2017, it is the basis for everything. The charges are based on what Flynn told the FBI, and 302 is the record of what he told the FBI, and it just happens to be missing. And Judge Sullivan basically said, oh, you know, things happen. Understand.
You know, Byron,
inexplicable.
What's inexplicable is only explicable this way. Donald Trump does things to people that are completely impossible to predict. I thought Robert Mueller was a great choice for special counsel. I believe the press clippings and his stature in town, as did all my friends from the Reagan years. He would be fine. That investigation went off the tracks, went way off the trail, captured by partisans within it and dominated by partisans within it. I thought Judge Sullivan, given his record in the Ted Stevens case, would be a perfect judge for this. He's repudiated his reputation as hell-bent on prosecutorial misconduct. There is something about Donald Trump that unmoors people from who they were.
Well, my particular theory is, if you listen to a lot of critics of Trump in the media and politics, they describe their opposition to him in moral terms, that what he has done is immoral, what he has done has endangered what America stands for. And I think if you look at a threat in moral terms, it justifies almost anything you do to meet that threat. And so I think that they have felt that since Trump has violated all of these norms, remember that was a big phrase for a long time, Trump has violated all of these norms, well, you have to fight norm violations with norm violations. And so we've seen that, and you're right. It has meant we've seen professions change their standards. We've seen it in law. We've seen it. Remember, and this is a small example, but in psychiatry, remember the Goldwater
rule? Oh yes.
Rule?
Oh yes.
And well, the Goldwater rule just went out the window with President Trump, and you have all sorts of professional licensed psychiatrists telling us that the president is crazy. Very, very common. So all sorts of standards have gone out the window in this time.
Byron, what I think is the most grievous danger, and I've talked about this with Dr. Larry Arnn of Hillsdale, Matt Spaulding of Hillsdale, others. Trump, whatever you think of him, has not violated any constitutional norm. In other words, he hasn't refused to enforce the law. He's abided by rulings of the court. He's lived by the Nixon v. U.S. doctrine that the Supreme Court is the final arbiter of these. He does prosecute his rights as much as he can. He refuses to cooperate with Congress in perfectly acceptable constitutional showdowns, but not extra constitutional behavior. The left in result has become unhinged. They do not value federalism. They want to get rid of the Electoral College. They want to get rid of the Senate. Increasingly, they don't care about freedom of religion or freedom of the press or assembly or petition. They've actually just sort of abandoned the Constitution, and that's what's really going on here. As the United States and other countries begin to slowly open up following the initial wave of this pandemic, business in China is at great risk. Many distrust the communist regime, and with good reason. Some say it's time to take our business elsewhere. Sebastian Gorka discussed what's next with writer Victor Davis Hanson.
What is the most realistic way to modify Sino-U.S. relations after this outbreak? We don't have the evidence that it's man-made, but we do know that they seeded the world when they allowed people from Wuhan to travel. We know they intimidated scientists, journalists, destroyed evidence. What's the fine line between overreaction and what? How do we do China relations differently is what I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, I think it's all based on our perceived self-interest. So we want to back out of the saloon with our guns drawn. We don't want to just cut them off when they have a monopoly of our pharmaceutical, rare earths, medical supply, military technology. So we've got to be very nice to them and just say, you know what, we're going to go a different path, but we're going to continue the relationship and then insidiously move this stuff either to countries that we can trust, like Japan or Korea or maybe Vietnam or Mexico. or here in the United States for some of this stuff. And then we need to have a long-term plan of really redirecting American education away from all of these sociologies, environmental studies, peace studies, and get back to, you know, engineering and math and sciences. We're not producing enough mid-level engineers to do the type of design work and engineering work that we need to have a viable domestic industry. That's why we're bringing in all these people from India, and we shouldn't be doing any of that. And it's because we're turning out the wrong type of college graduate.
On the first priority, this surreptitious repositioning of those production relations to other countries we can trust or countries that are close to us or domestically, would the eventual goal, Professor Hansen, be to have zero reliance on anything made in China? Is that realistic?
Anything that is that matters in a type of time of crisis, obviously, if they want to make, you know, plastic ducks or swing pools.
Toys,
want to make,
whatever, right.
Yeah, whatever, hula hoops. But we shouldn't rely on them for anything like pharmaceuticals. I mean, we should be willing to pay a couple of cents more for an amoxicillin or an Augmentin pill,
yeah,
with a guarantee that we have it, than to pay less when we don't know how it's made or how safely it's made or whether we're ever going to get it. So I think within limits, we want to make as many things as we can here, or we want to have our allies make it. If we have a problem with Mexico on the border, we can. I'd rather have things that we don't want to do here outsourced to Mexico than China, because that will keep people in Mexico and help the North American economy. But it's going to be very difficult, because we're talking kind of parlor talk here in America, and for them, it's an existential question. So they interpret that as, these people will destroy us if they shut down the world's largest market to our products. And so don't expect them to go quietly in the night. They're going to fight this tooth and nail. And they have a lot of assets at their disposal.
Coming up.
Always safety and health that the left uses as bludgeons for control.
Pete Hegseth, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Pete Hegseth of Fox and Friends has impeccable timing. Here we are during a pandemic with state governors coast to coast taking advantage of emergency powers to lock down everything from parks to churches. And he comes out with a book titled American Crusade, Our Fight to Stay Free. Pete was a guest of Dennis Prager.
When my dad enlisted, he wasn't drafted. He enlisted in the Navy in World War II. He never asked, is it safe? You can't have a society based on that question that is now the paramount question in America. Do you have any feelings about that?
I could not agree more, Dennis. I saw someone sent something out the other day, a contrast between, you know, World War II, the beaches of Normandy, men volunteering to get off of boats to what they knew, what they believed would be certain death, vis-a-vis the fear-based society we have right now of people who won't even leave their own homes. And it is always, Dennis, is always safety and health that the left uses as bludgeons for control. Listen, we understand science and we understand viruses and things like things you've talked a lot about, but it turns into fear, and then everyone asks, is it safe? I take it on in this book as well. The safety first culture is the enemy of free people, because risk is the definition of the ability to have success and the ability to stay free. Anything worth doing is risky, both in a physical sense, an emotional sense, a psychological sense. So I think you're spot on, and it's a massive challenge in our time right now.
Most people think that the human being wants to be free, but it's not true. The human being, more than that, wants to be taken care of. Freedom is a value. And that's why liberty, if freedom were natural to the human desire, it wouldn't have been one of the values of America. We wouldn't put liberty on a coin. We don't put breathing on a coin because breathing is natural. Any thoughts on that? Because it's clear freedom is not a value to a lot of people.
It is precisely what makes America exceptional. Why our republic was the exception to the rule in human history is the idea that freedom has to be trained, ingrained, taught. And that's why in the book, you're precisely correct, the left is the enemy of freedom. And because the Democrat Party has been captured completely by the left, it's become a party of anti-Americanism, and why these fights politically are quite literally existential. But we lose the political battle because that's a lagging indicator. And the left knows where we're susceptible. And it's in the minds of our young people. So it's our education. It's our media. It's our culture. In educating people, education never stops, because you have to pull that freedom value out of people sometimes, and it takes them understanding how special it is and how fragile it is. And Dennis, I think that's one of the silver linings of this moment, is that ordinary people are not politically minded. I mean, I call it the revolt of the salon owners, the revolt of the gym owners, who said, I just wanted a small business so I could feed my family and provide and be independent of government dependency. And now I'm seeing the draconian hand of government crush my ability to choose to be free. And I think that's teasing out the instinct that's latently there, and it could be turning more Americans into freedom appreciators, which has a political upside later on. But again, it's the left trying to uneducate that out of people, indoctrinate them, so that they can control them. I mean, that's what it ultimately comes down to.
A tiny number, relatively speaking, a tiny number. I live in California, where a tiny number of people have died of the coronavirus. I need to look it up. I suspect more people died of the flu this year in California than of the coronavirus. But in any event, it's probably close. The state is locked down. Commerce has been shattered. People's lives and businesses shattered. But the polls show that most Californians support the lockdown. What do you say to that?
I say it goes back to what you asked in the last question, the statement you made about the desire for security and the desire for safety and the dependency mindset that's trained into people. Also, this reflexive belief that the experts are right, that the authorities must be earnest, that the models, you know, were never disingenuous. And so I think, again, but it's never been the overwhelming majority of people who've kept us free. It's been the 2%, the 3%, the 4% who have reminded us, who have agitated us, who have forced us.
Coming up, the CEO of Facebook.
Frankly, I understand why a lot of people would be uncomfortable that a single private company would be making so many decisions about that.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. This week, I had a lengthy conversation with Mark Zuckerberg, the 36-year-old co-founder and CEO of Facebook. We covered a lot of topics, from China to Joe Biden. But our key exchange came on the decision of Facebook to appoint an oversight board to decide what is and isn't acceptable on its platform, what is and isn't seen by the public. Facebook is not allowed in China, but China is allowed on Facebook. And right now, China's running an IO against the United States, which is comprehensive. The disinformation campaign about the origin of the virus is as sophisticated as any I've ever seen. And I've been in this business for 35 years on the intelligence side for a while. Is Facebook taking a side in that effort of China to rewrite history on the virus? Are you actively trying to purge from your platform their disinformation?
So we're doing a lot on misinformation in general here. And, you know, I guess there's really three categories of work that we do. One is you have these sophisticated information operations that come from sophisticated governments. And, you know, we've seen the most activity from Russia and Iran, but we have also seen, in some cases, some signal that there's some coming from China as well. And there, you know, we really have gotten a lot more sophisticated at this since 2016. Our partnerships working with the intelligence community and the U.S. government and governments around the world have gotten just a lot deeper across the tech industry, to the point where over the last 3 or 4 years, we've now identified about 50 of these sophisticated information operations coming from these different countries and have shut them down. And that's largely been about political interference, although I do think that with the pandemic around coronavirus, that is an environment that some nation states might look to exploit. So this is something where we're very aware of and are looking at very closely.
What was the objective of the oversight board when it comes to content moderation, for example, if China is pushing disinformation on the origin of the virus? What is the objective of the oversight board with regards to that content? Does it get to them?
So the oversight board is kind of going at a different vein of what we work on. But basically what we've found is that people want an independent organization that they can appeal to if they think that we're getting something wrong on content. Right. So, you know, people obviously really care about having the ability to have a voice. And you know, I really care about that. That's a big part of why I created the company. But then you get into all these very complex nuances, like no matter what you think about free expression or giving people a voice, you obviously aren't going to want to support, you know, terrorist content or child exploitation or some of these really terrible things. And you know, even U.S. tradition, which is the strongest free speech tradition in the world, we have principles like you can't go into a movie theater and yell fire in the middle of a crowded theater because it could put people in imminent risk of physical harm. So all the debates then flow downstream from that to how do you define what is harmful and what isn't, and how do you make it so that people can express as many possible things as they would like, but you just try to cut down on the things that are truly going to be dangerous. And those are they're philosophical questions, they're political questions, they're going to be debated for forever. And frankly, I understand why a lot of people would be uncomfortable that a single private company would be making so many decisions about that. So we embarked on this process to create a self-regulatory body, which we call the Oversight Board. And it's made of basically people from all walks of life, former judges, former prime ministers, you know, people who have run nonprofits, academics. And they come from all different backgrounds. It's a very diverse group. But the one thing that they all have in common and that we vetted them all for is a very strong commitment to giving people a voice and free expression.
Have you got a sense of how the conservative or the center-right American political opinion makers have reacted to the Oversight Board yet?
A little. It's a new thing. So I think that people have questions about how it's going to play out. I think at this point, I think more people know where I stand on free expression. I mean, I gave this speech in Georgetown last year. I think at this point I've made some very hard public decisions on coming down pretty strong on the side of giving people a voice and free expression. So I think people kind of understand where I am on this. And now we've established this new oversight board. You know, people have questions across the political spectrum about how will this board influence the process? Is it going to be as strong on free expression as I am? On the other side of the spectrum, I think a lot of people worry, is this going to get to good outcomes because Mark and the team were so focused on appointing people who believe so strongly in free expression. So I think that there are questions about how this will play out, but the announcement of the Oversight Board was never meant to be the end of the process. I think it will rule over time, I imagine, very thoughtfully and transparently, and I would imagine in a way that will be very protective of people's free expression.
We really want 15 foreigners moderating content about American political discord. In other words, how did you end up with a group that most sort of free speech absolutists like me say, oh my gosh, that's not a free speech group. That's a bureaucracy like the EU.
Look, I would encourage folks to not oversimplify this to the point of saying that someone who isn't American can't care about free expression. I think that that is
Well, that would be stupid. That would be stupid. But the American standard is the most rigorous in terms of allowing speech. As you said earlier, we are the most protective of speech in the world. And a lot of Europeans aren't. I mean, British libel laws are not particularly good. Before we run out of time, Mark, I got to ask you about politics. Joe Biden came after you personally in a December 16th sit down with the New York Times editorial page, saying, I've never been a big Zuckerberg fan. I think he's a real problem. He wants to revoke Section 230. He wants to make you civilly liable. Does that worry you that one of the two nominees for president doesn't like you personally?
I mean, someone did share those comments with me when I think he made those. And, you know, obviously, you know, running an enterprise like this, that isn't the type of thing that you want to see. But look, I mean, overall, I have a lot of faith, maybe more than I should, but I have a lot of faith in American institutions and democracy overall. And I think to some degree you have to if you're building something whose mission is to give every person a voice. Because, you know, these days there are a lot of people saying, hey, you shouldn't give everyone a voice. And you know, that's what democracy is all about, is that everyone should be able to vote the way they want, should be able to express their views, and that through that process you get to a better outcome for everyone over time. You know, I have confidence that, you know, whichever way this goes, you know, there are good institutions. There are a lot of good people who are coming at this with good faith, trying to solve problems that they think are real problems. So I don't know. Maybe I'm still naive on this, but
the late Charles Krauthammer,
I would rather live in our country under our system than anywhere else in the world, and I'm very proud of our kind of the way that our system works.
For the rest of that discussion with Mark Zuckerberg, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up,
our liberties, including our religious liberties, are not suspended during a national crisis.
Vice President Pence in the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in a moment. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. Ravi Zacharias, the great apologist, dies at the age of 74. We'll hear from those who were shaped by him. John Stone Street.
There's a lot of thinkers who have been taught to believe because of Ravi.
White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany.
Billy Graham was a great evangelist. And I think Ravi Zacharias is the great apologist.
My colleague, Eric McTaxas.
We will never know until we get to heaven how many people's lives were changed by him.
And we'll hear the heartbeat of the man and his central passion.
To me, he is the way, the truth, and the life. And as long as there's breath in my body, that's what I want to proclaim.
A special edition of the program. We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. At the height of the lockdown, it did not escape notice that churches were closed, but the liquor stores remained open. Eventually, churches started to gather. Some just in cars, and the more overzealous governors, typically in blue states, issued warnings, ticketed cars, even arrested participants. In a recent discussion with Vice President Pence, Dennis Prager addressed this issue.
Do you believe that the religious American is better equipped to deal with this?
Well, I think from early on in this crisis, I've been deeply moved at the way every American has responded. I mean, it's since the advent of the coronavirus, the American people have made incredible sacrifices, put the health of others first. We've saved lives. We've flattened the curve. 30 days ago, the president unveiled our plan to open up America again. But all along the way, the faith and strength of the American people has been an inspiration. You know, churches, synagogues, other places of worship have not been able to meet during the time of strong mitigation efforts, but they've continued to reach out to their communities. They continue to support people. And there's just not a day goes by that I don't get a stack of mail that almost every letter is punctuated by people that say, you know, my family is praying for the president, praying for you, praying for all of those impacted by the coronavirus. So I just have no doubt that's been true throughout our history, that the faith of the American people is seeing us through this. And as we see states around the country reopening, we see the progress that is not reported enough in the media than is present company accepted. But the truth is that 34 states today, even as we're increasing testing, 34 states today have a less than 10% positive rate over the past week. We see cases going down. Most importantly, we see fatalities going down. And it's a tribute to the resilience, the strength, and the faith of the American people.
All right. So on the issue of churches meeting, for example, do you think there right. is a religious liberty problem here in telling churches they cannot meet?
Well, there has been, and it's one of the reasons why, at the president's urging, you saw the Department of Justice make it very, very clear that we would step forward. Look, our liberties, including our religious liberties, are not suspended during a national crisis. And we saw an instance where a church was literally fined and sanctioned for having, I think, 16 people in their pews, socially distanced on a Palm Sunday, Dennis, when the church actually seated more than 250 people. The DOJ actually weighed in on that case, and your millions of listeners who cherish your strong convictions and your voice for religious liberty can be confident that under this president, this administration, we're going to continue to stand, as we have from day one, for the religious liberty of every American of every faith.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. On this Memorial Day weekend, let me express our gratitude to all who have served our great nation, those who fight, those who've been injured, and those who have paid the ultimate price. To you and your families, a grateful nation says thank you. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producer Charlie Richard, David Posey and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.